Let's go to a passage. Let's go to chapter 2 of Genesis. In chapter 2, go to verse 8. It says, the Lord God planted a garden eastward in Edom. And there he put the man whom he informed. Eastward from where? You have to have a point that you're going to determine what is east from. We'll go to Jeremiah chapter 17. In Jeremiah 17, let's go to the verse 12. A glorious high throne from the beginning. From the beginning. In the Hebrew, it's the word Rishon. From the beginning. Is the place of our temple. You go to chapter 43 of Ezekiel. He says, this is the place of my throne. You could go to 1 Kings chapter 8. And Solomon says, this is the place of the throne. You could go to Exodus 25. Verse 8, verse 9. Where he tells the people to build me a temple. Build me a mikdash, a house of kedusha. In there, and I'm going to show this in my presentation this afternoon, it says specifically, just so shall you make it. You may not change it. You may not alter it. In 1 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 11 through 13, it states that every building, every structure was given by God. And the people were instructed not to alter it. In the temple, you have a rule. You cannot add anything. You cannot change anything. It is, you know, John Kennedy and probably the most popular first lady ever, Jackie Kennedy. And one of the things that she did was she took people on a tour of the White House. It was televised. And she came in and she remodeled everything. Temple, you can't do that. It has a blueprint to it, a tafnit. Now, Abraham comes to Mount Moriah, and he is told on one of the mountains there. The word for mountain in Hebrew is the word har. So it says, on one of the harim, okay, plural. There are actually, the word har can mean a mountain or it can mean a peak of a mountain. And there are three peaks to Mount Moriah. One is the one we call the Temple Mount. The second is called Antonia Hill. And the third is Golgotha. And that's where Yeshua was crucified. He built an altar there to offer Yitzhak, Isaac. And of course, God supplied a ram in his place. Later, David sins. It numbered the people. And so, God sends an angel to bring a plague on the land, on the people. David repents. And he's instructed to go up and to purchase the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite and build an altar. And that altar is built in exactly the same place where Abraham had built his altar. Then we're told in the Chronicles that it's not a matter of that it's a tradition or it's something that was handed down. We're told in Scripture that Solomon's altar and the temple were built at the exact precise location of where David had built his altar. In Ezra chapter 5, when the people return from Babylon. The temple has been destroyed, and it specifies that the temple be built specifically the exact same location. Now, we're told in 1 Chronicles 28:13, actually in verse 12 to go before, we're told that by the Ruach HaKodesh, and it uses the word Ruach, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, that David was given the plans to the temple. Again, it's going to be this word Tavnit, which means specifically the blueprints. Not only is he given the plans to each building, where it's to be located and how many cubits it's to be high or wide, all the various courtyards, the storehouses, where the choir would stand, every single item, but we're told that he was given the services. The services, a lot of people think the services are something that the rabbis put together. It's not. In the temple, everything was given by God. They could not add to it. They could not take away from it. They could not change it. Now, it's where that God will teach us primarily two things. It's called Beit HaMikdash. The word Mikdash means house of Kedusha. If you know the word, the Ruach HaKodesh. Kodesh means holy. Holy. Sanctification. I thought I understood the word holy. I got hold of a book several years ago. It was written by a rabbi, well-known rabbi in Israel, and it was called The Temple, Its Meaning for Today, Tomorrow, and Forever. It started off with the first chapter was called What is Kedusha? What is Kedusha? I read that chapter, and I found out after 30-some-odd years of studying and studying and studying, I didn't know this basic concept of the Scriptures. So, let me ask you something. What man do you think in the Scripture? Now, I'm not talking about Yeshua. I'm talking about a personality. What man do you think is going to be called holy most often? Who? Moses. Moses is never called holy. I want personalities, not a position. David's never called holy. Let me cut to the chase. Nobody is. It's not used in reference to individuals. How many places, how many buildings are called holy in the world? One. How many times in the book of Genesis, Bereshit, do we have the word holy used? One time. One time. He made the Shabbat holy. The next place you see it is Exodus 3. Moses at the burning bush, take off your shoes, for the ground you stand on is Kadosh Atbat, holy ground. It's never used in reference. How many times did I used to say, well, that's a holy man, or this is a holy work, or this is a holy building? Only God can make something holy. He makes his festivals, his appointed times. He made a Kedusha with them. He makes certain offices, the high priest and the priesthood, are holy. The people of Israel as a whole are holy. The tithe is holy. The various korbanot are holy. The vessels we have within the temple are holy. But you and I can't make something holy. We can enter into a holiness with God on something that He has made holy. So why is the temple important? Because we need to understand these words. It's where He teaches us how to worship. It's where He teaches us the correct ways of worship. There's a statement in the Midrash that if the Romans had known the value of the temple, they would have brought all the legions of Rome to surround it and protect it. There's I don't have the time to go into this one part that I really would love to go into with you. But I'm going to give you a real short version of it. Every day, the Kohanim that are used in the service. Now, you have a morning service, and you have an afternoon service, and then you're going to have services in between for individuals' private korbanot that they're bringing sacrifices. But the morning service is called the Shacharit. The afternoon service is called the Mincha. At the end of the Shacharit, every day, 13 Kohanim. There's 13 Kohanim, or priests, that are going to be involved in that service. They are going to come out in, let's say this is the temple building here behind me. They're standing on these 12 steps. They're called the 12 Malot. Now, the ones that went inside the building are going to be down to the right-hand side, which would be the south. They're all on a certain step, so they can't be on whatever step they want. They have to be on these certain steps, okay? And so the ones that went inside, they're there. And then you have the rest of them are going to be here, and they're going to raise up their hands and do their hands as a sheen, and they do the priestly blessing. Yeah, but this finger was broken, so I can't do it right with that. But you've seen Star Trek. You've seen Spock, okay? Leonard Nimoy was Jewish, and he learned that in the synagogue. But it makes the sheen for the Shaddai, okay? And they do the priestly blessing. Now, there's a rule within the temple. In the inner courtyard called the Azarah. The Azarah means to bring peace, to bring comfort. The word Azra comes from that same word. So, if you're in the Azarah, you cannot sit down. Only if you are a king descended from David are you allowed to sit in the Azarah. King Agrippa wept because he couldn't sit down in the Azarah. There's a death penalty if you sit down in the Azarah. So, I mean, it's no question about it. You can't turn your back on the Holy of Holies. There's a death penalty. But when the Kohanim come out, they have their backs to the Holy of Holies. When they raise their hands, they have their backs to the Holy of Holies. Why? The people, to this day, when they call the Kohanim up, the Kohanim will put a talit over their head. There's two reasons for it. One is they're basically going inside their prayer closet, but the other is you're not supposed to look at their face. You look at their feet. And they don't have anything on their feet. Nobody in the temple wears anything on their feet. They're barefooted. Excuse me. You look at their feet because the blessing goes, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you, be gracious to you. The Lord give you shalom. Lord give you peace. Yeah, the blessing's not coming from the Kohanim. It's coming through the Kohanim. It's coming from the throne. It's coming from Hashem himself. But if you just take that ceremony, you're not catching what's happening. Because leading up to this, starting well before morning, well before daylight, everything has been going in a procession. And so a priest is chosen, specifically chosen. He goes and he draws the water for the kior. And he washes his hands and his feet at the kior, the laver. And then he comes up the altar, and he starts to prepare the altar. And so other Kohanim will come running, and they prepare the altar. It's still dark. They will select the priest who are going to be participating in this service. This is going to be in the chamber of the Sanhedrin. And they will send one of the priests to a high spot, and he looks out to see if the sun has come up over Hebron. Now, Hebron, what's significant about Hebron, or Hebron, you might know it that way. What's significant about it? Abraham was buried there, right? The cave of Machpelah. And Abraham and Sarai and Isaac and Rivka and Yaakov and Leah. Okay? And in Jewish belief, That's where the resurrection will begin. And so everybody else believes that the second place that it will occur from is the Mount of Olives. And that's why the largest cemetery in the world is located on the Mount of Olives. And the whole western slope of the Mount of Olives, the eastern slope of the Kidron Valley, is Jewish cemetery. So they ask, has the light reached as far as Hebron? Because see, sleep is a rehearsal of death. Waking up in the morning is a rehearsal of life, resurrection. First thing you do when your eyes pop open in the morning, you say, Modeyani Lefaneka, Melechai Vekiyam, Shehek Ezorta, Binishmati, Behimla, Rabbah, Imunateka. I gratefully thank you, O Lord my God, for restoring my soul to me in faithfulness. Every morning you wake up with this idea of resurrection. But in the temple, you start. The temple is going to start with this idea, the sun is rising, of resurrection. So they will start to prepare the lamb that they have to kill. The priests that have been, they're going to slaughter the lamb. That lamb has to be facing. It's body south. Its head is turned. Its head's to the south, but its face is turned to the west. So it's looking toward the Holy of Holies. The coin that's going to slaughter it is on the east side, looking toward the Holy of Holies. He's going to take it. He's going to cut its throat. And another coin is going to grab, have a vessel, and they get the blood. They're going to have to take this blood, and they're going to have to go over to the altar, and they're going to have to throw it on two sides of the altar at its corners. Now, then they will start to cut this animal up. Inside, they are going to send the group of priests that have been selected to burn the incense and to prepare the menorah. So the first Kohen goes in, and he is assigned to the menorah. And he's going to come in, and he has certain lights that he's going to clean them out, put new wicks in them, put new oil in them, and make sure they're lit. Then he comes out. Another priest will go in, and he's going to take the old ashes and the coals off the altar of incense, and he prepares it. Then he comes out. Now, at this time, they're going to have where they've got the animal cut up, and then different priests are going to carry it. It's very specific of which part they're going to carry up the altar and how they carry it, which hand they carry it in. Everything is specific. And so they are starting to go up. They sounded instruments called a magrapha. It's very loud. We suspect that it was bagpipes. We're not sure. At that point, the choir comes in, and they come to the platform. There's three steps there. They go all the way across. It's 135 cubits across, and they're going to go up on the steps. Now, the Kohen are lining up with these parts of the animal to go up the altar. The choir is taking positions, the musicians at one end, the singers at the other end. The young children of the singers, the young boys, will stand at their feet to give a sweetness to the melodies. Behind them, or actually they're facing towards these people in the court of Israel, we're going to have 24 delegations come in. This is called the Mabad. They're coming in from the 24 districts of Israel. We have the Kohen is going up the altar. He's going up with a silver shovel to get coals in the shovel. He will come down, and he transfers those coals into a gold shovel. He's going to take the shovel in his hand, and he has a censer in his other hand, and he's starting into the holy place. He's going to the altar of incense. Now, as he gets in at the altar of incense, he's going to put the incense, the coals down, and he smooths them out, and he puts the incense onto the coals. Now, as he does that, he's going to start to pray the Amidah. Out in the court of Israel, when he starts to pray the Amidah, they can't hear him, but they know exactly when he's going to start, they're praying the Amidah. All over, up in the upper city of Jerusalem, people know this is the time. And they're praying the Amidah. All over Israel, people are praying the Amidah, facing towards this throne. Now, as the Amidah is being prayed, the priests are coming up the ramp, and they're starting, they stand on the ramp, and they throw onto the fire these sacrifices. As they finish that, the men are finishing the Amidah. The choir starts to sing, and they're going to sing the psalm for whatever day it is. There's a psalm for each day of the week, and they're going to sing that psalm. As they finish that psalm, that's when the priests come out. That's when they come to those 12, to the 12 steps. That's when they raise their hands. And as they raise their hands and they start to sing the priestly blessing, they're going to sing, pronouncing the name. It's the only time of the day that they will pronounce the name. They do the priestly blessing earlier in the morning, but they don't pronounce the name. But at this time, they do. Why? It's not just that they're saying, the Lord bless you and keep you. It's that all of these things come together at that moment. All of these, offering up that burnt offering, the songs that were being sung, the people praying together, the smell of the incense, all of that joined together. And then the Lord bless you and keep you. It is a prayer for harmony and peace to go out to the world. That's why we need the temple. That's why we need not only to understand it, we need to embrace it. When Moses goes up on the mountain to receive the Torah, how many commandments does he receive? 613. What's the first commandment he's given? Bring Torah or free will offerings, verse chapter 25 of Exodus, verse 1 through 6, through 7, there'll be a mikdash. How many chapters will it be before we have one command that is not related to the temple? 36 chapters later. How many commandments of the 613 directly relate to the temple? 271. What do we deduce from this? You can understand the Torah, but you'll never fully understand the Torah until you see it through the lens of the temple. This is why it's so important. So, this is from a course that I teach. I have a course on the temple and the establishing the location. I guess I have to be over here to do this. I guess I have to turn it on. Yeah, get it? All right. We're not going to worry about a lot of this, okay? Do I have to be facing that? All right. There is a northern theory of where the temple was. We're not going to go into that. Still not going forward. All right. I'll show you. This was put forth by a man named Asher Kaufman. All right. There's a problem. Can y'all see right? All right, so do I need a new battery? All right. Can y'all see, while they're getting me changed up here, can you see the Boston platform? Do I have it off or something? Okay. All right, let's go back just. All right, can you see the Boston platform right here? Makes a little triangle. Look at it here. See that? That's the Dome of the Rock. It's right here. Okay? So Asher Kaufman placed it on the north side. Here's the Dome of the Rock. Here's the Boston platform. And so we have all this area around it we call the Temple Mount, 35 acres. There's a problem with it, and I'm going to show you right here. There is a moat that is located right there that was on the northwest side of the temple. It was there to protect that side because the ground was high, and the enemy could come in. They built a fortress there they called the Baris, and then you had this moat. The moat is spoken of by Josephus as being filled in by the Roman general Pompey. Charles Ward in 1868, Palestine Exploration Fund explorer, discovered the moat, measured it, and charted it. I'm going to show it to you later. Okay, problem with Asher Kaufman's northern theory is he's building in an area. His northern wall is going to be in the moat. You can't do that. You can't have something that wasn't, it has to be there through every period of the temple. So we're going to go far. This is the fosse where it talks about, but even here stood great towers and a trench had been dug, and the temple was surrounded by a deep ravine. And that was filled in, but we found that. Here's the moat. See it? That is there. This is a map that was done in the 1865 to 1868 by the explorers from the Palestine Exploration Fund, Captain Charles Wilson and Captain Charles Ward. They were royal engineers. And this is the moat. Right here is where he has his temple, his northern walls in the moat. Okay. So we're going to go forward. And there's another theory that the temple is on the southern portion down here. This is what we call the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And this is the Dome of the Rock. Now, right here is a fountain called the Al-Qas Fountain. And let me go forward. I'll go show it to you. It is located right in here. Right here. All right, now watch. See it right there? That's it. Okay, now that is where Tuvius Agib says the temple is located. He has a problem with that one. The problem with that one is that the Temple Mount, the original Temple Mount, was 500 cubits by 500 cubits. Then it was added on to by the Hasmoneans. Then it was added on to by Herod. Well, his southern wall is in the part that was added on by the Hasmoneans. So that don't work. Okay, so we're going to go. We talked about this the other day. This is Martin and Cornuke's theory that it's off the Temple Mount. Oh, I'm just going to show you a picture real quick. This is what is called the burnt house. How many have been to this? Yeah, do you know, Tim, whose house that was? Yes, this is part of the Herodian Mansions, but let me go to the burnt house. Okay, burnt house was owned by a man named Katros. Now, do you know what Katros is? In the Talmud, we're told that he was a high priest. Now, Professor David Flusser, who's very, you want to read his stuff, as well as Dr. Ronnie Reich, a very preeminent archaeologist, wrote a paper on the name Katros, and his Greek name, translated in English, is Caiaphas. Okay, that makes it interesting. This, I wanted to show you this here. You see how we have stones standing on top of stones? This was discovered. Now look at, go back. All right, we're going to go here. I'm going to jump way ahead. All right. All right. What we have described, we have two primary sources that we have on the temple as it looked at the time it was destroyed. Yeah, we have, there's a ruling that we have to build according to the Tavnit. That is a biblical ruling, according to the floor plan. And we have to build according to the last temple standing, the floor plan. So that is one of the things that we're trying to determine is where every building was, what were the measurements used, how did all this function, how did it operate. So our two primary sources outside of the scripture. Scripture does not give us descriptions of the buildings and so forth. There's a lot more that is there than what you would recognize just reading, okay? There's a lot more that's there. But our two primary sources are going to be Flavius Josephus, who was a priest and an eyewitness to the temple. So he wrote quite a bit about this. He described buildings, stairways, all types of things. The other is going to be by another priest named Eleazar ben Yaakov. And he wrote several books. One is called Midot, which is in the Mishnah. Midot means measurements. All right? So they both describe a stairway that comes up to a monumental or to a platform. Now, this platform is called the Hell. That is not H-E-L-L, not hell, but Hell. Okay? Hell, how many of you have done Havdalah? Number of you have done Havdalah. Okay? Havdalah, you do at the end of Shabbat, you do at the end of a festival. And it separates from the common days, the holy days from the common days. Okay? So you have a prayer. It's called the Habadvil prayer. And you start off with Le Habadvil, to separate. Le Habadvil, bain, between Kodesh, Lachol. Okay? Between the holy and the common. You heard the word kol? Le Habadvil, bain, Kodesh, Lachol. Okay? Kel, right here, this word, is talking about this platform, which was 10 cubits wide, and it went all the way around the inner courtyard. Now, you have a problem in the Azarah. You can't do what? Tell me what you can't do. You can't sit, okay? What else can't you do? You can't turn your back on the Holy of Holies, okay? So, I have a question for you. Yom Kippur, you're going to bring the high priest, and he's going to be there for a week. Okay? Now, he's going to stay for a whole week. Now, if a building, you see this building right here, there's a building. See that? See that building? See this door? That's a gate. Now, give your perspective. This gate is 4 stories high. That building is 8 stories high. Okay, so the gate, if it opens owed to the Azarah, it has the rules of the Azarah. So what's wrong with this picture? Now, usually your high priest is going to be an older guy, usually. Okay, so let's say 70 plus. And you're going to tell this man, Yom Kippur is coming. You have to stay here because we can't take a chance of you getting impure. And you have to do everything perfectly. You can't make any mistakes on Yom Kippur, but you can't lay down for a week. Now, that's not going to work. Okay? Here, it gets worse. There are no toilets. Okay? There are no toilets. You can't turn your back. So you always have to face, you always have to walk like this, okay? So it's complicated, right? Well, there are markers inside the building. These markers are going to be Kedusha markers. If the building opens owed to the inner courtyard, it has the rules and regulation of that courtyard. It has the sanctification of that courtyard, okay? But if it also opens onto the Kel, in that end of the building, you can sit. You can have quarters to sleep. You can, Tim did in his talk, what do the judges have to do with a judge? What's that? Yeah, what do the judges have to do with a judge? They have to sit. All right? The Sanhedrin meets in this building right here at this inn. So the Kel is a very important part. It has a high kedusha, has higher than outside in the outer courtyard, has a lot of rules, but there you can sit, there you can lay down, and they have passageways to tunnels which take you to the toilets. Okay? So there is a system that operates. All right? So, in the about 1990, Dr. Barrett's working with an archaeologist. I'm sure you know him really well. Who's your archaeologist? Shimon Gibson. Shimon Gibson was the archivist for the Palestine Exploration Fund. Palestine Exploration Fund has nothing to do with the Palestinian people. The whole country before 1948 was called Palestine. So in the 1860s, the people in England wanted to learn the archaeology of the Holy Land, and they formed an exploration society. Okay? So they sent all these explorers that went, and they published all this work, and they were allowed to go down into the underground passageways of the temple. We can't do that anymore. And so this young man, his name was Tirit Drake, was sent to with Lieutenant Claude Cunder. And he was the photographer. And so he took a picture in March of 1870. In fact, he took two of them. I have both of them. This is one of the pictures right here. You see that stairway? Okay, so this stairway, Shimon Gibson is the photo archivist for the Palestine Exploration Fund. This young man dies. He gets malaria. And he dies just after he took this picture. He goes to Jericho, and he takes him about a month to die. I mean, he was pretty sick, and it was a horrible thing. And generally what would happen is they'd take his pictures and send them back to the Palestine Expression Fund, and they would publish them. But in this case, because he died, they packed up all of his camera, his equipment, sent it to his family. So his family took and put it in the attic after a while. Well, in 1990, 120 years after he took the picture, the family decides we got to clean the attic. And so they go up there, they clean, they find all his own equipment, they know the story of him, they donate it to the Palestine Exploration Fund, they print up the picture. So Shimon Gibson's sitting there and said, wait a second, what is this stairway right here? I've never seen this. Could this be the stairway that is mentioned in the Mishnah going up to the hell? Or could it be the stairway mentioned by Josephus going up to the Kel? Now, in the Mishnah comes from the east. It describes everything coming from the east going to the west, whereas Josephus describes everything going from the south to the north. All right? It's an important point to note. This is coming from, this is coming from the south. All right? So, the question was, what is a stairway? I mean, it doesn't mean it's from the temple. It could have been from the Romans. It could have been from the early Muslims. It could have been from the Crusaders. So there's a lot of possibilities. All right. Now, that was on the south. And Charles Warren, goes up on the Temple Mount in December the 8th, 1868. The previous night, they had a huge thunderstorm. And they had a cave-in. You see the top of this tunnel? To the top above it is only 3 inches. Only 3 inches. This tunnel was revealed just off the Muslim platform. Yeah, I'm gonna rub for it. Wait, here we go. If I could keep it still. All right. See number 37? He located this tunnel. And, I mean, they didn't know it was there. And it runs parallel with the northern edge of the Muslim platform. Now, they knew it was a temple period tunnel based upon the stones within it and its architecture. It was 18.4 inches across, which is every tunnel they have discovered from the temple period is 18.4 inches across. It had what was called a barrel roof. And so they knew that it was from that. Back 3 years earlier, Charles Wilson had discovered another tunnel right here. Now this tunnel, it ended right here. In other words, like you wouldn't go any further. There was natural stone wall. However, at this end, it had been blocked off. They plastered over it and converted it into a cistern. So that was done in a later period, probably by the Muslims. But what was weird about it is on this wall right here, and coming down on the southern end were benches. Benches. Yeah. Why would they have benches in a tunnel? Okay. Yeah, my allergies, really. Nobody ever understands anything I say. All right. So here is Wilson's tunnel. Right over here is Warren's tunnel. Now, let's go back. I'm going to give you just a short, very short part of all this. Here's one of Warren's drawings. He shows the rubbish in it. This is the natural bedrock under the Muslim platform. This is the level of the Muslim platform today. Okay? So here we have in the Emidot, as well as in another book that was written by Eliezer ben Yaakov, called Tamid, that describes the morning services, the Shacharit service, gives details on it. We have a problem. I'm going to rub back. There'll be a test on this after a while, so you have to remember everything. You see this building here? This building is called the Beit HaMoked. It's the dormitory of the priest. It means the house of the heart. They have fireplaces to keep the priests warm. Now, in this corner, right here, we're told there was a stairway. It's called a masiba, which means that it's a winding stairway. All right? Now, the priests are sequestered in here for a week. They come on duty. They come on Shabbat. They go off on Shabbat. And so you can read about this, like in 2 Kings 11, several places in the Scripture. It tells us about it in the Mishnah and Josephus. Okay, so they are shut up and locked in that building during the night. Now, if they want to serve in the temple that next day, they will get up about 3 to 4 hours before sunlight, because the superintendent's going to come and he's going to knock on the outside. And if you aren't ready, you can't go serve. But what do they have to do? They have to go to a mikvah. You know what a mikvah is? That's going to be an immersion chamber, and they have to immerse. Now, that, by the way, this is going to be the basis for one of your parables, the parable of the 10 virgins. And if the priest, when the man knocks, if he comes in, and you haven't been to the mikvah, you can't say, wait a minute, let me run down to the mikvah. You have to be ready when he knocks. You have to be ready to go right at that moment. Now, down in the mikvah, it says that there was a chair of dignity. Okay, so what do you think a chair of dignity is? It's a toilet. A chair of dignity. And that this was a superior one because it had a lock on the door. And if you knocked and nobody responded, you knew it was empty and you could go in. So the people go to, the priests go down, they go to the toilet, and then they immerse, and they have to come back up and be ready. However, if during the evening, all right, can you fix it for me, please? All right. So if during the evening a priest had a seminal omission, he's disqualified. He's what's called a Baal Kiri. It means a master of imperfection, and he cannot even be in the Azarah or a building that opens onto it. Okay? So he goes down to the mikvah. And for 1,800 years, there was arguments about, it says in Tamid and Bidot that he came and he sat next to his brothers until the gates of the temple were open, and then he went out through the tunnel that went below the hell. And he went out exiting through Tadi. Tadi is going to be a special gate. And it's constructed totally different from every other gate. So this argument for 1,800 years is, how could this Kohen, who is a Baal Kiri, come back into the Beit HaMoked? Because it opens onto the Azarah. Are y'all following me? Am I losing you? I'm trying to keep it where you can really grasp it. But the deal is, the tunnel is going to be right in here. And it goes down, and it turns, it comes this way. Now let me go back. Maybe I have to go forward and find out. Let me try forward. Yeah. Okay. All right. So he came. Here's where the toilet is located. Captain Charles Warren located the presence of where the toilet was located. It's underground. So the priest would come over here, and then he would come into this tunnel by a passageway. We haven't found the passageway, okay? But he would sit on the benches until the gates of the temple were open. Yes, okay. And then he goes out this way, turns, and he comes through this tunnel and right along here. We know where to look. We just can't go up there and dig. We know exactly where the Tadi would be located, but it would look like this. This would be the tunnel. Finding that tunnel was significant because we need to prove that the steps on the southern side from the Tirat Drake picture. And there is another picture that was by a man named James McDonald, also done in 1865. He was the photographer with Captain Wilson. And Debbie and I went to University of Texas. They have some originals from their work, and we got them to, we got high resolution pictures of all this and everything. But Wilson had drawn a map of this stairway, this monumental stairway that's on the other side. He had did measurements on the size of the steps, what the tread was, and all of this. What was most significant is at the top of the steps, there was a pavement, an ancient pavement. And so we have pictures of it from James McDonald. So here's the thing. If we could prove that this was the Kell of the South and that was the Kell of the North, then we would have a major step towards having exact locations for the temple. So I want to show you something. Here's where Warren found the, this is Warren's maps. And this is where he found the print right here. It talks about that there's a large chamber below right there. That's the location for the thing. We measured in between the monumental stairs on the south and Warren's tunnel on the north. The measurements were done by Conrad Schick, who also worked with the Palestine Exploration Fund. Guess what? It split the Dome of the Rock right down the middle. Exactly. Precisely. And so, I want to show you some other things. There's a lot that I can show. By the way, this is, you might have seen it on television, Simka Jakubovici. And we're inside what's called the Zistos. Now, Simka is about this much taller than me, I'm going to guess. John, you know him. He's about this much higher, right? Or more. Yeah, he's a tall guy. And you see this. This is burnt ash. All this below him and about 8 feet above him is still an intact building that wasn't destroyed by the Romans. You have one stone standing on top of another stone on top of another. All right, so let me go forward. Now, let's look right here. All right, this is the southwestern corner of the Temple Mount. This is an artist's drawing. This would be the southern wall. And can you see right here that there's a stairway and it goes up? You see that? All right, there's people going on it. You see there's a gate up here. And you see there's a gate right there. Okay, this is the western wall. All right. Now, you see this right here. That's what we call a spring stone. Let's go back. That's going to be right there. In 1967, all right, 1967, I have photographs actually from the 1800s and then after of men sitting on these stones and their feet are on the ground. There was dirt in 1967 all the way up to here. All the way up to there. Let's go forward. You see this pile of debris? That's stones that came down off the wall and they were left there as a testimony. It's when the Romans destroyed everything. Now the stones literally came, the stones that they knocked off the top literally came up this high on the wall. Debris. All right, now I want to show you right here, and I want to show you right there. Okay, y'all saw that? You don't know what you saw, though, do you? All right. Before we look at that, I want to show you that underneath, there's a walkway that goes right over this. Just like where you saw the stairs going up on the south, it's going to level off, and there's a walkway. This is a little strip mall. All right, this is a shop. That's a shop. This is a shop. The Romans put hay and tar and all types of stuff inside of here, and you can see that where it plastered the wall. There's still burn marks where they burned the shops. All right. So here, you see the blue area. Everything that's how low from here down was debris. Okay, this is on the eastern side, the southeastern side. Let me go back. All right. Yeah. Give me a second. I'm going to get back to something. I want to show you something. All right, here we go. What happened? All right, you see this picture? The debris was from this point down, the gray, from what they knocked off. And everything is original stone from below that and then right above it. This is going to be different stone today. And here's where that arch spring stone for Robinson's Arch that comes down this way. Okay, so up here is a point I showed you. Remember, and I showed you right down here. It was illegal to go on the Temple Mount unless you were a Muslim. Muslims wouldn't let anybody up there. If they found you up there, they would kill you. And so in 1865, a very, very rich British lady offered to give the city of Jerusalem a brand new water system based upon them being allowed to survey the existing water system. She was going to donate it to them. So the Jerusalem at that time was in the hands of the Turks. And so they allowed that. So they sent these engineers over, royal engineers, and to go in and to examine all the cisterns. And so they went in, they examined, they took photographs, they did drawings, they literally wrote books, did all types of things. We could not do what we're doing today if it was not for the work that these guys did. Now, they weren't allowed to dig on the Temple Mount. They were still under the jurisdiction of the Muslims. And the Muslims don't let you do much. So anyway, what Warren did, Warren is going to dig shafts. He dug one right there. There's several on the western side. He dug on the eastern side. He dug down in the city of David. They have a very famous place to go in Jerusalem. It's called Warren Shaft. And he discovered some of the water system down in the city of David. Okay. So he has this equipment. By the way, people would come from England and all over Europe and go down in these Victorian dresses and everything, down in these shafts. And that was a big thing to do back then. And so, anyway, 1967, Six-Day War, Israel defeats the Jordanians and other Arab armies, and now East Jerusalem is in their hands. And so, while the Temple Mount was turned back Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan turned back the authority of the Temple Mount back to the Muslims, so we still couldn't go up, do measurements, do these digs and all these things. They began to work at the southern steps and to excavate the southern side in the southwestern corner. All right, so they have cleared away all of the debris. They locate buildings that are here. Some of these are going to be Muslim buildings. But this, do you see that little black spot there? That's Warren's shaft. That's the end of his shaft. It doesn't go any deeper than that. Now, Warren has all this drilling equipment. And he had, here's his shaft here. See it? I'm going to go back. All right. This stone was literally, here's the shaft on the ground, the hole. And it was sticking over the hole. And his drilling equipment had cut part of the stone off. And so it's missing. They never found it. But they know what this says because we have it recorded. It's actually in the Tractate Sukkah of the Mishnah, and it's recorded by Josephus. And it says, to the house of the trumpeting to separate between the holy and the common. Lehamadvil ben Kodesh Leho. All right? And we're given all the trumpet blasts that were done. And I'm going to show this in my presentation this afternoon about this stone. Okay? And what Josephus tells us is that a priest stood at the top of the temple. And he blows before the Shabbat. He's going to do it early in the day, like at noon. He'll blow three times on a silver trumpet, not the shofar. And that's to tell people, start shutting your shops down. Then he will come back and he's going to blow three more times when Shabbat begins. And that means it's over. Okay? And there's going to be so many blasts that are done in the temple. Now, let me show you. They found not only the trumpeting stone, but they found the top of the temple mount. Okay? Now, look at this. They found the entire top. This is not the trumpeting stone. That's a plaster remake of it. The original is in the museum. But this is where the stone went. That's where the priest stood. They found that in the pile of debris. Okay? That tells you the temple was here. Those stones weigh tons. Can you imagine Titus saying, okay, now listen, y'all. We all know the temple's down here at the city of David. 2,000 years from now, they're going to think it's up there. Let's really do a joke on them. I want 150 soldiers to carry these stones a third of a mile uphill. We're going to place it at the bottom of the pile. Then we're going to tear down a whole section of that wall on top of it so everybody will think it's up here. Okay? Now, I'm not trying to be facetious. I'm trying to say you want positive proof. You want to be able to show somebody where the temple was. I can show you cisterns all day. I can show you tunnels all day. But that's going to be a matter of interpretation and putting it. This is hard evidence. Okay? So, anybody know Deanna Dye? That's Michael Dye. All right. So, let me show you this one. There is a chamber. It's not a chamber. There's a building over here. So here's our tunnel. This is where the priest with the bench, B-E-N-C-H, sits. Here is, before Debbie, this. I know you're not, okay. I know you're not. All right. Here's the tunnel that was found by Charles Ward, okay. Now, we have, down here was the Beit HaMoked. Beit HaMoked. Beit HaMoked is going to be the chamber of the hearth. Remember, that's the dormitory for the priest. Big, important building. Huge building. I mean, these buildings are just beyond your belief. The temple building, how tall do y'all think that was? 22 stories. 22 stories high. The veil of the temple, how tall do you think it was? 8 stories high. Took 300 Kohanim in order to hang it. How many of these 8-story high veils do they have in the inner courtyard? 13. How many in the temple building? 4. Which one tore at the time Yeshua was resurrected? Which one? Right. It's the one on the outside. It's called the heavens because it was decorated like the Milky Way. We have 2 descriptions of it. But people usually say, the one between the holy place and the holy of holies. My question is, which one? There were 2. And it's neither one of those. Okay, so we have on the corners. The corners are important. Quarters are going to be important. We were talking about this in the sukkah last night, that you have quarters, the kanofet, or where you put your tzitzit. The tribes are going to be gathered for the quarters of the earth. You have quarters all over the place. Quarters of the altar, where you have your horns of the altar. So you have, in the temple, you have quarter buildings and these special meetings associated with that. So we have up here is the Beit HaMoked, but down here we have what's called the Beit HaNitzotz. Now, y'all know what Beit means. It means house. Nitzotz means spark or flame. Okay, so there are a number of cisterns that are going to be all over. I'm going to show you in a few minutes how many cisterns there are. But right here on this corner, we have three cisterns. Three cisterns. So this top one is called the Beer Ha'afir, which means the bird cistern, because it's kind of shaped like a bird. Okay? Then we have this one. And this one, Shmuel Gibson and David Jacobson wrote an article on this cistern. It's called the oldest datable cistern on the Temple Mount. Okay, so that is called the Bir Es-Sawani. That is an Arabic name, and it means cistern of the fire rock. Cistern of the fire rock. Which, if you were to translate that into Hebrew, it would be Bir Nitzotz. Okay? So here, this is cistern number 27. And it was discovered by a man named Comrade Schick. Okay? Now here, this is the bird cistern. This is the fire rock cistern, Bir Es-Sawani. And here is cistern 27. Now, cistern 27 was not originally a cistern. It was originally a mikvah. And so, how do we know it was a mikvah? I hope I have... Yeah. They found stairs in it. Now, it is exactly going to be east of the Beit HaNitzotz, which is on the southeastern corner. Then you see that the soil drops down. Do you see the level of elevation drops down? There's a reason for that. Because the Azarah is going to be 6.5 cubits higher than the Court of the Women. And the Court of the Women, it had four chambers on the corners. And one of the chambers on the corners was the chamber of the lepers. And the lepers were told in the Tractate Nega'im of the Mishnah had a mikvah below it. Mikvahot are great because they are cut out of the rock. You can't move them. And they will tell us where everything is located. We're able to figure where they're located. But anyway, they found this and answered one of our big questions is, here's your chamber. A lot of times you see this drawn on the inside of the Court of the Women. But we have the, it answered that it was on the outside, right here. It was configured, not like this, on the inside, but on the outside. All right? So let me go forward. I want to just show you something real quick. All of this we could talk about extensively. This is one of my favorite places. I go here to pray sometimes. This is a cornerstone. Do you see that stone? That is a cornerstone. It is from the time of Nehemiah. Let me run back real quick. I'm about to go to question. You see this? Wait, yeah, this worked. These are called, this is Hasmonean stone. This is where the Hasmoneans added to the temple in the south. Now, just past that, you see all this stone? That's Herodian. The stones are going to be, they're worked different. We have what's called, the stones are called ashlars. They're big. And they have what's called a margin around them, okay? It looks like a picture frame. And then you have a raised portion in the margin. and so the how much that's raised, like in a Herodian stone, it's usually on about a quarter of an inch or so. If it's a Hasmonean stone, it's going to be up to 3 inches sticking out. You can see how rough these are. See that? See how that's sticking out? All right, now, in the Persian period, see, this is Herodian, this is Hasmonean. It's where they joined the two together. All right, now this, in the Persian stones, they're more rounded. They have a rounded boss, and we call that the boss, but this one in particular was the northwestern corner, northeastern corner, excuse me, of the Temple Mount, of the original 500 cubits by 500. That stone is mentioned, by the way, in the book of Nehemiah twice. And I like to go there and stand there to pray and just be a part of that original temple, that original time. We are the generation that will see the temple come back. It has been, a few years ago in Israel, they thought the Jews that went up on the Temple Mount were the crazies. Well, today, almost 90% of the Jews of Israel believe that they should pray on the Temple Mount. They believe now that the Temple Mount is coming back. And the whole thing has changed. And right now, it's going out to the nations. And so, you are being called by God to recognize the day, the time we live in, to be a part of this. The command to build that we have in Exodus 25:8-9, I'm going to present this later on, but it is a command that applies to every generation. It is written in a tense called a continuing tense. So I'm going to stop here and open it up for any questions.